I'm Ronald Dupuy. I'm from Ilmenau University of Technology, and what I'm interested in, you will hear in a few minutes. So basically, I want to give a short status report about our recent work at the Big Barrel of Ilmenau, and particularly I'm going to talk about the viscous boundary layers and what we can learn from local velocity measurements. This is an experimental work, and most of the experimental work has been done by my PhD student Ling Li. She's working since 2009 at the experiments. Then there are several other people involved in the work at the Barrel of Ilmenau. Here, those people from the experimental side. Here, those people from the numerical side. Please let me mention Jörg, who contributes to this talk with some numerical simulations. So all what you see in numerics is from Jörg and his group. I shared my talk into two parts. The first one is a rather informal part for all those people who are following our experiments very closely. What are the technical news at the barrel? What could we improve? And what we are doing now. And then in the second part, I want to discuss the viscous boundary layer measurements. So let me briefly recall the basics of the Rayleigh-Benard problem. I'm apologizing. That's probably probably due to the other computer.
It's just white.
Yeah. So you have to look something like. So there's a fluid layer heated from below. That's true. Cooled from above. That's true too. And it is described by five dimensionless parameters, which I'm going to use later on. This is the Rayleigh number, the aspect ratio, the Prandtl number for the input of the system, and the Nusselt number and the Reynolds number for the output. I think all of you are very familiar with this stuff, so I must not explain it more in more detail. So let me start with a rather basic question. There are two different ways to study Rayleigh-Benard convection, and one group of people, or one way, is to rather study the global characteristics. That means people are interested in global quantities like the heat flux, the typical velocity, or global flow structures or flow dynamics as well. And they aim basically to predict scaling laws like the well-known relation of Nusselt or Reynolds over Rayleigh, gamma, and Prandtl. And then there is another group which is more interested in the local details of the flow. They are mainly focused on boundary layers, on local transport or turbulent dissipations. And their aim is to look how these local quantities varies with the parameters, with Rayleigh, or whether there are significant variations. One of the prominent examples is, for instance, the transition of the boundary layer from a rather laminar state to a turbulent state. And so those two groups have also different approaches to build up experiments. The first group focus on, of course, maximum Rayleigh numbers, since all of the natural flows, or many of the natural flows, are at high Rayleigh numbers. They want to cover large parameter domains and accurate measurements of the global quantities. And since they want to have, on the other hand, small experiments, they usually use fluids with a very low viscosity, like I'm apologizing for this. This might be not quite correct. Low temperature helium or compressed SF6. So the disadvantage of these experiments is that they are so small that local measurements are really hard. And this is the other approach. We build up big experiments, and then if we apply small sensors, we can really resolve the local field structure. And usually these experiments have been done in air or in water, where we have a virtually unrestricted access for our measurements. So this is our big barrel, which belongs to the second group of experiments. It is not designed to achieve the highest possible Rayleigh numbers, but the size of this big barrel is that huge that we really can measure local quantities. It is basically built up, as each Rayleigh Bernard experiment, a cylindrical container, a heating plate at the bottom, a free-hanging cooling plate at the top, which can be moved up and down. And below you find the most important parameters, Rayleigh numbers up to 10 to the power of 12, if you compare it with the highest achieved, the Rayleigh numbers in the world in experiments of 10 to the power of 17, you see this is certainly not the highest one. Aspect ratio, ratios between 1 and over 100, and a fixed Prandtl number. Here are some technical details which might be not so important. And here you see a picture of the experimental facility. It's electrically heated. Electrically heated? Cooled with cooling liquid, yes. So, even in the barrel, it is of crucial interest to span a wide parameter range in Rayleigh and gamma. So, and just to remember what is the parameter field of this big barrel, I plotted here the accessible field in the gamma and Rayleigh space. And what becomes clear is if you want to keep one of the parameters constant, for instance the aspect ratio, then the variation in the other parameter is very small. So basically, if you keep the aspect ratio constant, then you can vary the Rayleigh number by 1.5 decades, or if you fix the Rayleigh number to a certain value, you can vary the aspect ratio by a factor of 10. This is certainly not sufficient to really explore some variations with the Rayleigh number.
What is the maximum delta T that you can set?
Well, the maximum delta T is 60 degree, 60. Yeah.
And the reason you can't go to lower Rayleigh number is?
It's the limited small low temperature drops. So basically it is a big experiment and we limit ourselves to a temperature drop of about 2K between the plate. Otherwise the uniformity is of the plate temperature is not really good. So
but you could really bring plates close to there.
Yeah, we can. Yeah, but then the aspect ratio changes. We have a fixed diameter. If we bring the plates closer, then the aspect ratio changes.
It also poses problems for uniformity when the plates are close.
Yeah, it makes things better. It makes things better. But if you see, if we change the aspect ratio, then our parameter field travels to lower Rayleigh numbers. So that's why we decided to build up a smaller inset into our big barrel, which is shown here. It is also of cylindrical form, made of plexiglass, so it is fully transparent for measurements. And as you see it here, it has basically the same height as the diameter. It is slightly distorted by the picture here. So basically it has the same height as the diameter. It is built up from rings. So if we compose several of these rings, we can also adjust different aspect ratios.
Does it tilt on the top and the bottom?
It is heated by the big heating plate and by the big cooling plate.
How is it sealed?
Sealed with a foam, with a simple foam.
We know from our experiment that the seals could be very good.
Yeah, I know it.
It's high really.
But
we see no difference.
No, but on the other hand, we will not measure global quantities, the global heat flux. We are rather interested in the local quantities. For instance, the boundary layers here and here. So we don't think that it is really affected. Yeah, really affected.
Who made the plexiglass wall?
Who
made the plexiglass wall?
Oh, it is a small company close to Ilmenau. No. They designed this barrel for us.
Local place, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's get the address.
Do you want to have it?
Yes.
You can have it.
You
can have it. It is quite good. We often work together with this company.
Is it seamless?
Is
it seamless or is it seamless? That doesn't matter. Just go. You have no time.
Yeah. So here we have the new phase space and the new parameter field. This is the old one, the green. This is a blue one, which is from the small barrel, and now it's clear we have a broader parameter range. For instance, if we keep the aspect ratio at 1, we can vary from a Rayleigh number of 10 to the power of 9 to 10 to the power of 12, which is basically a doubling of the parameter space, and the same in aspect ratio for a fixed Rayleigh number. We can vary the aspect ratio roughly by a factor of 10. And then there's another advantage which might be interesting for those people who are dealing in numerics, and that's the originally aim of this small barrel. Presently, the people dealing in numerics can compute Rayleigh numbers up to 10 to the power of 9, 10 to the power of 10 with direct numerical simulations. And if by reducing our Rayleigh number, there is a certain field in the parameter where experiment and numerics collapse and where we really compare the data from experiment and from the numerics. So far to the technical news. Let's come to our present projects very briefly. Basically, there are two projects that we are working on in the moment. This is very, very recently started. We are interested in the distribution of the local wall heat flux at the plates. And this is due to a work of Kitching Xia and our very recent work, that we find that the thickness of the boundary layer, which is plotted here, this is a relative thickness of the boundary layer over the plate radius or the plate diameter. And what you see here in the center of the cell, the boundary layer is very thin, and as closer you come to the sidewall, the boundary layer thickness increases by, here in Kitching's experiment, 60%, which is huge, which is not negligible. And we found roughly the same during our local heat flux measurements, that the local heat flux here exceeds the global one, that means the mean over the plate, by a factor of 2. And that's why we are interested to look in more detail. And we have basically two approaches. The first one is we want to look what is the distribution at all. So keeping the aspect ratio fixed at 1, increasing the Rayleigh number, what happens here with the distribution of the local heat flux. The other approach is keeping the Rayleigh number constant and changing the aspect ratio, what happens with the local heat flux distribution. It's to be supposed that this distribution becomes uniform at high aspect ratios, but we want to check what happens in between. And the idea to do so is quite simple. We have the heating plate or the cooling plate, if you want, with a more or less uniform temperature, which we can measure. And then we cover this plate with a thin silicon pad. And this thin silicon pad creates a temperature drop according to the local heat flux at the wall. And then we use a high resolution infrared camera looking from above and measure the surface temperature of this silicon pad. And from this surface temperature, we can easily derive this local heat flux. So that's the idea. And then you can change this, you can change the Rayleigh number.
So the whole experiment is covered in this silicon pad?
Yes. Yes.
I see, and you do that because of the emissivity?
Because we what?
Oh, I see, you use the silicon.
We use the silicon to have temperature drop. So otherwise we would measure in a more or less uniform.
You change the boundary conditions, right?
Yeah, of course, you have a change in boundary condition. That's why we use a high resolution camera and we limit the temperature drop to about 1K or 1.5K.
What fraction of the applied temperature difference is it? Well, the temperature variation at the top of the silicon, how much is that compared to the applied temperature?
Yeah, it depends on the Rayleigh number which you want to study. So usually we adjust 40K, 30, 40K, and then it is a fraction of, yeah, let's say 5%.
How many percent?
Five.
Which is, I think, okay.
Well, no, it's 5%.
It's 5% now.
It's fully okay, otherwise it wouldn't be there.
So, and basically, our ideas to measure are listed here, some average quantities like the distribution of the local heat flux at constant gamma or fixed Rayleigh and varying the other quantity. Then we hope, we don't know whether it is really possible, to analyze the global flow structure at variable gamma, analyzing the footprint of the large-scale circulation on the plate. So the large-scale circulation should create something like a footprint at higher velocities. There's a higher local heat flux at smaller velocities. There's a smaller local heat flux. And we hope that we see this footprint with the infrared camera and can study the global flow structures for different aspect ratios. And if we will find those transitions between aspect ratios, then we are of course interested what are the flow modes and where are those critical aspect ratios. And then there are some ideas to study instantaneous quantities. For instance, we have the idea to study the mean flow orientation like Günther did with the temperature sensors around the cell. So we can study this then from this footprint at the plate. Or what we also can study, if we have something like a traditional regime, let's say aspect ratio close to 2, where we know something, there's one role, something there are two roles, we can study the probability of those different flow modes close to the critical limits. So this is basically the first project which...
So you're saying there's some of the facility is low mode, yeah? I mean, you have transfers, I mean, not only this way, you have the other direction too, right?
Yeah, of course you have, but basically we are right at the beginning of this. We check it first in a small experiment to get ideas how accurate these measurements are, and then we go to the big barrel. So, and this is the second project. I think it was already mentioned during this day. there are some analogies found by Eckhart, Grossman, and Loza between different model experiments, Rayleigh-Benard experiment, Taylor-Cuyet, and pipe flow experiments. And those analogies are due to the near world transport and the structures in these experiments. Basically, those authors derived a more or less formal analogy from the Navier-Stokes equations. And actually, there was created a Forscher group, which Björn is incorporated, where Jörg is incorporated, and some other people here. No. And to study these effects, and our part is the experimental study of the Rayleigh-Benard convection, and we will mainly focus on the flow field inside the boundary layers. Here's the parameter range which we want to study, 10 to the power of 9 to 10 to the power of 12 in Rayleigh, aspect ratios between 1 and 10, and then we want to do this also at various locations at the cooling plate. That means not just in the center, but also out of the center. We are going to measure temperature profile, velocity profiles, all three components. Then in the next higher step, we are going to measure temperature and velocity simultaneously in one point to find out the local heat transport inside the boundary layer, which is quite interesting. And then we have the idea to do some PIV or PTV measurements in the boundary layer, which is not quite easy in a cylindrical experiment where the flow orientation always rotates or fluctuates, so where we don't have a fixed flow orientation. But that's rather a future project. So actually, we are here at this point, and this will be the next part of my talk. So let's, now I have two H's, one on the side, one here. Now let's recall the Rayleigh-Benard problem again. The fluid layer with the heated bottom and the cooled top plate. For experiments, this point is crucial. Usually we have a finite extent of the cell, and for all the experiments which I'll discuss now, we limit to an aspect ratio of 1. That creates a mean flow with a shape like this, one large circulation roll, and with a typical velocity u infinity. This t might be wrong. It should be a u. And this, I'm apologizing again. And this creates, this mean flow creates boundary layers. And since we know that these boundary layers are, or these boundary layers determine the heat transport in turbulent Rayleigh-Benard convection, let's look more detailed what happens. So we consider the boundary layer at the top plate. This is a plate surface. We have the flow from the large-scale circulation here with a typical velocity u infinity. And this creates a shear layer and a mean velocity profile where the temperature grows from 0 at the wall to u infinity at the edge of the boundary layer. And then we have an additional thing, namely a strong temperature gradient between here and here. And due to this temperature gradient, there might be an additional velocity component which develops normal to the wall and which is indicated here with V perpendicular. So and we, and if such a component in, exists, we have asked ourselves, what is the nature of the heat transport throughout the boundary layers? And basically you can rewrite this in a form, so I have to tell you what's usually here. There's a diffusive fraction minus lambda times the gradient of the temperature dt over the wall normal distance dz plus an advective fraction of rho, which is the density, times Cp, which is the heat capacity, times the mean of the product of the wall normal velocity fluctuations and the temperature fluctuations. And basically, one can imagine three different scenarios what might happen inside the boundary layer. The first one is that what we usually use for moderate Rayleigh number, not too high, that means below the so-called Kreisnan regime. And this is the idea of a laminar boundary layer. And let me remember here, or no, one step back. A laminar boundary layer according to the model of Prandtl-Blasius. And let me remember here, this model is just for a stationary and a two-dimensional flow, which might be important since we have neither a stationary nor a two-dimensional outer flow in turbulent Rayleigh-Benard convection, at least what at least in experiments of cylindrical shape. I think small fluctuations might be allowed, but basically the wall normal velocity component should be small compared with that component parallel to the wall. Then basically parallel streamlines develops as seen here, and the heat transport is of diffusive nature according to Q is minus lambda dt over dz, and this leads to a temperature profile which is basically linear and which has been observed particularly in water experiments, rather not in the air experiments that we did in the past. Then there is a second scenario. We assume that the laminar boundary layer is basically conserved, but now we have stronger fluctuations. U prime, V prime, and W prime, but all fluctuations are smaller than the typical velocity U infinity. Then basically the parallel streamlines are also conserved, but they are broken by some fluctuations. And this leads to a diffusive and an advective transport written here, minus lambda times dt over dz plus the advective term. And for this case, we restrict these two terms to that the diffusive terms is always larger than the advective term. And then there's a third scenario, which has been described by Kreisnan. This is a fully turbulent boundary layer, as shown here. What you see is there's just one streamline parallel to the wall here that indicates the viscous boundary layer, which is always there close to the plate. But then the boundary layer is completely turbulent. You have a full mixing, and we assume that the fluctuations are of the order of U infinity. And then you have a mainly advective heat transport. That means this advective term is larger than the diffusive term. So now what is our task? Our task is to determine this. Basically, the diffusive term we can get from the local heat flux right at the wall, which is of diffusive order, so we can get it from the temperature profiles or from local heat fluxes, but we don't know this term. And nowadays we did one step to get this term. We measured the wall normal velocity fluctuations. Actually, we cannot measure both simultaneously, but we can measure at least one part, and this is what I would want to present you. This is our measurement setup. We use laser Doppler anemometry, which is a local measurement. That means it provides provides the velocity just at one local position, but over a certain time period. We arranged two LDAs, a 2D and a 1D LDAs, and they are arranged in a way that the measurement volumes collapse all in one point. We measure through the cooling plate, which is this blue thing. There's a glass window inside. The beams go through the glass window, meet in the boundary layer, and since we can move the whole arrangement up and down, we can probe every point here in the boundary layer in distances from close to zero up to 200 millimeter. Unfortunately, those probes are arranged in a way that they provide non-Cartesian velocity components, U1, U2, and U3. So first we have to transform this to the Cartesian components, which is easily possible and which we combine with a filtering process where we filter out some outliers and something wrong results. Here is a photo of the full arrangement. These are the LDA probes, the black tubes. Here is a cooling plate. Here is the center at the window in the cooling plate, which corresponds to the center of the experiments. And below this window is our measurement position.
Do you circulate water through this glass window, or is it just
no.
Block of glass?
Yeah, this is a block of glass, and we assume that the temperature is more or less homogeneous. It is quite good coupled to the aluminium frame, so, and it is not really huge.
Okay, the glass is not conducting heat right
now. Not really, but there was a question to buy a sapphire window, which is very expensive and actually out of our funding.
You have not got the video camera?
No.
Stop before you
had
the camera.
We hadn't the camera. We got it a couple of.
What about the index of refraction variations due to the heat?
Inside the air?
Yeah, for the LDA.
It doesn't make any disturbance. There is a paper from Christian Rezak. He studied this in more detail, and he found out that for air, basically, the temperature gradients are not strong enough. So in water, it looks completely different. So now to the task. We are interested to measure the horizontal velocity profile, and I already mentioned the situation in a cylindrical Rayleigh-Benard experiment that the orientation of the flow permanently changes. And I've plotted here in this diagram the relative angle of the large scale circulation over a period of 48 hours, which corresponds roughly one cycle of our velocity measurement. And what you see, there is basically one mean angle, which is here about 30 degrees, and then it fluctuates down, up, down again with an amplitude of about 90 degrees. So
why doesn't it meander all the way around?
Not all the way around.
The preferred orientation.
Yeah, it is.
Something indeed breaks the azimuthal invariance of the system.
Yeah.
Do you know what it is?
We don't have an idea. So usually this is all in the small barrel. Which means, yeah, this small barrel is inside the big barrel. That means that the boundary condition is really adiabatic, since we have
does it have a seam?
A what?
Does the plexiglass wall have a seam? Or is it?
No.
Is this on board zusammengeschweißt, this plexiglass?
No, it's simply put it together. It's not really fixed. And no, we can out later. I think there is no way for heat at the, a certain positions where the heat loss is slow.
Well, it must be very hard to get your plates exactly flat, though, right? I mean, they're so large.
No, there's a stable support which holds the plates. So there are not just the plates. There is something like in Germany, it's a Fachwerk. I don't know whether there is.
I think what Bob is saying, that it's kind of tricky to make them
really
level, right?
No, it's not.
Parallel.
No, it's not really hard. It's not really hard. As I said, there is a stable frame which holds the shape of the whole thing, and basically the plates are just put it into the frame. We can look for some pictures after the talk. So in fact we have a strong variation not only at this particular Rayleigh number, but basically at all Rayleigh numbers between 10 to the power of 9 and 10 to the power of 12. And that's why we have to apply a little trick to compute this mean horizontal profile. I'm going to demonstrate this at a Rayleigh number which is one decade lower, since I want to show you some of the numerical results of York. So we go down to 3.4 times 10 to the power of 9. The aspect ratio is 1 and the Prandtl number is that of air, 0.7, and we probe different measurement positions, 1 hour at each position. And then we compute a wall parallel velocity as a magnitude of both horizontal velocity components u and v. That means we transform our Cartesian coordinates in a cylindrical coordinate system, and we keep the wall normal velocity, and then we plot it in a diagram which you see here. So what do we have? There's a distance from the wall in real units of millimeter. This is in order to compare it really with the numerics. There is the mean velocity parallel to the walls, and then we have plotted three things. We have the experimental data from the measurements, which are the red dots. Then we have numerical data from York's simulation from a DNS, and then we have the Blasius prediction according to this dashed green line. And this Blasius prediction is fitted to the numerical data. And basically we have three regions which are worth to discuss. There's the region very close to the wall where experiment, numerics and Blasius really fits well. So there is a good collapse. Then we have the region out of the boundary layer, where according to the fitting of Blasius, numerical data and the Blasius prediction also fits well, but where the experimental data are slightly higher, by about, I would say, 10%. I don't know why it is, and the difference is not really huge, so we haven't think about this more detailed. But then we have a region which has already been discussed in the near past. This is the region here where not only our data but also the numerical data of Europe deviates from the predicted Blasius profile. So basically from here to here we have this deviation. And now those people who know the work of Keqing Xia will remember that he has the idea of a dynamic space transformation of the profiles. So he published this very recently, and the idea is basically he take an instantaneous velocity field which he measured in a small rectangular cell with PIV and which is plotted here, and then he compute for every time step, or he extract for every time step a velocity profile like this. And for each time step, he compute an instantaneous thickness of the boundary layer according to this algorithm. So he took the velocity gradient of the curve, and the crossing point with a maximum velocity is its instantaneous boundary layer thickness. And then he scale all those instantaneous velocity profiles with respect to this dynamic boundary layer thickness. And what he found in his experiment, and I think also in some numerics, that this algorithm fits the profiles. It is shown, it is demonstrated here. Here we have the mean velocity. Here we have the rescaled distance from the wall. And the blue dots are the raw data. That means the unscaled velocity data. The red dots are the scaled data according to this instantaneous DV. And this is a Blasius prediction. And what you see is it fits quite well. And now our idea was,
so what happens with the simulation?
Same thing. I think so, yeah.
Look.
Well, not with York simulations are different. Different thing that I want to talk about.
Oh, okay.
Immediately. So basically it would be nice to do the same with the measurement, but this is not possible. Since we don't have instantaneous velocity fields, we just have an instantaneous velocity at one point. So we cannot compute any instantaneous boundary layer thickness. But York can in the numerical simulations, and he did, and the results are plotted here. So basically the blue curve, so basically he went the same algorithm according to the same algorithm like Keqing, and we plotted the results here. This is a Blasius prediction, the blue profile, and then you see these are the curves, the real curves in the cylindrical experiment analyzed by the same algorithm like Keqing's. And for the cylindrical experiment you see the deviation still survives.
Why is there a slight overshoot in the Blasius profile, Ronald?
A slight overshooting?
Overshoot, yeah, looks like a slight overshoot. It goes up.
In the experimental data?
No, in the Blasius profile.
No, it's not.
The Blasius is flat, but the experiment, the velocity has to go through zero if you go through the center line of the sample. Yeah.
So this is completely flat.
Yeah, okay.
This is completely flat. So and one of the ideas was that the averaging time was not long enough. So in the first step, York did it with 100 time steps. So please correct me if I'm wrong.
Samples.
Or samples, yeah. This is a black line And then he increased it again and again to 400 samples, and you see there's basically no difference between the short averaging time and the long averaging time.
Samples were increased based for all cases?
Yeah.
But what Shah and co-workers did was they determined a characteristic length by which they rescaled that was determined locally in time and locally in space.
That's what we also do.
That's are you really taking a small area?
Yeah. So what we are doing, probably I can just say, what we are doing is we are determining the mean wind, the local mean wind for that snapshot. We are aligning our analysis plane into the direction of the mean wind. And we are taking a little local frame in the center of that plane, and we are averaging over this. So it's like a PRV procedure, which we are repeating in the simulations. One has to keep in mind that the measurements were done for Prandtl 4, which is in water, and it helps a bit to improve the.
Yeah, just let me explain. I have. Basically, we are working very close together, so we permanently exchange our ideas. So, from my point of view, there might be two things which makes a difference between Keqing's Rayleigh-Benard cell and the cylindrical cell. The first one is Keqing have used a rather thin rectangular cell where the flow is really confined in one direction and cannot move. So in the cylindrical cell, we all know there's at least one more degree of freedom, which implies much more dynamics. So we have a fluctuation in the orientation, we have a shifting, we have distortional modes and something else. This is one of one of the reasons that I see for the differences. The other is the different Prandtl number. And let's have a look into the boundary layer in more detail. So on the left-hand side, there's a scenario for Prandtl 5, which is water. And here we have Prandtl of 0.7. And if we look for the ratio between the thermal boundary layer and the viscous boundary layer, the difference is that for Prandtl 5, the thermal boundary layer is nested clearly inside this viscous boundary layer, while for Prandtl 0.7, it's roughly of the same order. And now, we just look for the viscous boundary layer. What happens inside? If we assume that this is something like a laminar boundary layer with fluctuations, and as more we go far from the wall, as larger the fluctuations will be, and as more unstable the flow will be, then my intention is that the temperature gradient in this thermal boundary layers creates additional instabilities due to the buoyancy forces. So if this temperature gradient is only close to the wall, where the flow is rather stable, then basically nothing happens. If this temperature gradient also occurs far from the wall, in the region where the boundary layer is rather unstable, let me remember we have an outer flow which is far from laminar, which is highly turbulent. And that means this region is, I would say, rather unstable. And then we get, then we apply additional forces. Then it might be that the complete system gets unstable here. And this might be another explanation for the differences between the water experiments and the air experiments. So let's come back to the mean profiles. Let's go up one decade in Rayleigh, which is actually the highest one that we measured. And we did the same thing. We plot the mean velocity profile first. which is basically the same as for a relay, is 3 × 10⁻¹. But what I mentioned here is particularly this light red band. And this band indicates the statistical uncertainty of our experimental data. So let me remember, we measured 1 hour, which is very long and corresponds to about, I would say, 100 eddy turnovers in the flow. And this band corresponds to the 95% confidence interval. That means our statistical error, despite the long measurement time, is of the order of 10% here, which is not small, and which really explains why our curves are not that smooth as the numerical curves usually are. So what I want to note here is, whenever you want to measure some turbulent quantities in Rayleigh-Bernard convection, and those quantities are localized and not spatial averaged, then please take care to measure really over a long time. Otherwise, you might completely wrong. So this is the wall parallel velocity, and now I told at the beginning, we also are interested in the wall normal velocity, and this velocity is plotted here, the mean of this velocity, and this is a clear result. The mean is basically negligible compared with the wall normal flow. That's the situation for the mean. It looks completely different for the fluctuations. Here we have the fluctuations in terms of the simple standard deviation. This is to compare it with the mean flow. And I have plotted here again the mean horizontal velocity to have a reference for the other data. And here the horizontal fluctuations and the wall normal and fluctuations. And then we can basically share this region into two regions. So according to this mean profile, it roughly here goes to the plateau. We can discriminate in a boundary layer part left from this rod, and in another part, which is not really the bulk zone, but which is a region where the plumes acts very hard and where we have a lot of life. And if you consider these two parts, we see that basically the horizontal fluctuations, so let's go along one line, one distance here, are at least 1/2 of the typical mean velocity boundary layer, which is, from my point of view, also not negligible. Even the case that these wall normal fluctuations are rather small. But going away from the plate, then those fluctuations increase and increase and increase again. And here in this region where the plumes act, we have basically the same order of wall normal fluctuations and horizontal fluctuations, which is, from my point of view, close to a turbulent state. Even the case that this mean is about 3 times higher than the fluctuations. So that's...
Question?
Oh, yeah.
A little blip in the normal velocity at small z meaningful? Go back to them. There's a little blip down at small z. The green.
Oh, here. This is a measurement error. You remember, we cannot measure this velocity directly. We have to derive it from 3 other components, and this is due to this transformation. So it is really hard to measure this velocity at this point. You have to arrange the LDAs very, very precisely with, I don't know, 20 microns or so on, which is really, really hard. So, now the question, back to the question, which of the models for the boundary layer is really the right one? I think from all what we measure, this laminar model can we forget. So our fluctuations are not negligible. So those two models are left. The question, which of these models is the right one, actually we cannot really answer, since we only have one of these two quantities. So we only have the wall normal fluctuations, which are large, but we don't know what's about the temperature fluctuations. Basically, we also have temperature fluctuations, but not measured simultaneously. So we have profiles of the temperature fluctuations, but measured at a different time. So that's basically the end of my talk. But I will not finish with a conclusion as usual. Let me address a more or less provocative question. Assuming we have strong fluctuations here, maybe we are in this state or we are in that state, have we already reached the ultimate regime, at least what the center of the cell concerns, or what comes behind this state? So thank you for your attention.
For one of the questions, otherwise give lunch. I didn't understand your last question that you posed.
The ultimate regime predicts a turbulent boundary layer. It predicts a turbulent boundary layer where we have basically an advective heat transport throughout the boundary layer. So now the question is, we know we have a fraction, an advective fraction, that is proved by our measurements, but we don't know whether this relation is true or that relation is true. If this relation is true, then we already have achieved the ultimate state at this point.
So if you just take W prime, T prime, and take their magnitudes, and plug them in there. You know, I know they're not simultaneous, but that should give you an upper bound on
yeah, we could you get. Yeah, we could do so, but I haven't. I haven't. But I think I can definitely do this during these days here.
Okay, lunch break, and see you all in an hour.
Okay, thank you.